Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the creator of user-friendly fundraising software that helps nonprofits engage donors, raise more money, and save valuable time and resources. OneCause recently surveyed over 1,000 peer-to-peer fundraising participants to understand the key to fundraising success. Their findings are eye-opening. The study uncovers clear best practices for growing your peer-to-peer fundraising campaigns and empowering your fundraisers. Download a copy of the OneCause Social Fundraiser Study today by visiting www.onecause.com/responsive20. That's www.onecause.com/responsive20. Podcast listeners, thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We've got Tim with us again. He was with us earlier this week. We were talking about the fundraising profession at a really big macro level. We ended at a place where we're sort of getting down to the local. What are the considerations that maybe a local development officer needs to be thinking about his or her contribution to the profession? Tim, why don't you kind of keep us going with that idea? One of the things that I sort of left, one of the final thoughts that I sort of left us with was the notion that we've sort of boxed ourselves in and we don't have a bigger understanding of what it is our role is in society. I think that's is that a good place to sort of kick it off and finish this conversation?
Yeah, that's a good stepping off point, I think. I think that when we're doing our work on a daily basis, I think we know that we're doing important work and that we're making an impact, or I hope that is how people feel about their work. But collectively, I think we all need to be doing more to really fully embrace the importance of our role. I'll never forget being in the audience when Desmond Tutu came to speak to AFP's International Conference, and he looked at us in the crowd and said, "You are a noble profession." And it struck everyone. I mean, to have someone of that stature look at us and say, "You are doing noble work," it was gratifying. It was moving. People had a visceral reaction to that being said, having him say that to us. So, and I think it's true. And so, you know, how we invest in ourselves, how we view ourselves, you know, our perception of our work, how we are perceived by those who employ us and work with us, either as fellow staff members or with boards or volunteers, and how our profession is viewed generally by the public and by institutions and government and business. I think it's a really important thing for us to be thinking about. And as I said earlier in the broadcast, you know, some of us came into this role unintentionally. We fell into fundraising because of skill sets or connections or whatever brought us to the job. But if you pursue this as a career, and you do it over a long period of time, as I did, 30 plus years, you begin to develop an understanding of how important these roles are and the leadership role that we play in organizations, or should be playing if if that's not the case in a person's work. So that, yeah, so this is a good stepping off point to think about moving forward.
So, Tim, I had never thought about it this way. It'll be interesting to hear your reaction to that. But a lot of us in the fundraising profession that have been around certainly as long as I have and certainly as long as you have, a lot of us will sort of very confidently own up to that idea that we sort of came through the back door or we're accidental fundraisers. But does in some way that sort of signal some of the some of the weaknesses in what it is we're doing? So to, you know, it's one thing for me to be standing up in front of an audience, for example. And oftentimes I'm standing in front of a large group of people and inevitably I ruffle somebody's feathers with something that I'm saying, but I can generally get them to own up to the idea that we're accidental fundraisers, but then to get them to own up with some, to some of the things that sort of this notion that we box ourselves in, they're not likely to own up to that nearly as quickly.
No, they're not. You know, and I think the I want to give you a shout out for your book, by the way. I've read it and it's wonderful.
Thank you.
Because you're tackling some of these issues in that writing. But you know, I think moving forward, people are coming into this work more intentionally. And so that's a wonderful thing, and the opportunity for people to consider a career in fundraising as a noble profession, I think is exciting. And it was not something that in my generation I really had the opportunity to think about because it just was not on the radar. It was not anywhere in my ecosystem, growing up or coming up through, you know, my professional life. And only by circumstance did I find myself in a development role. And once being in it, realized how important a role it was and embraced it and made it a career, that I, you know, it worked very hard, to succeed in over a 30 plus year period. But today, students and families are recognizing that fundraising is actually a career choice and something that they can think about as they're growing up and then plan for as a both an educational choice as well as a career choice. And that's a new phase of our profession that I think we need to take seriously, and that has huge opportunities for us, both in addressing what I had introduced earlier, and that is this pipeline paradox. You know, we know that we have a huge number of people leaving the profession over the next 10 years. The pipeline to replace them is thin. And the talents and skills and competencies of the people in that pipeline may not be what is required to step into the senior leadership roles for those who are leaving the profession at the top of their careers. And so it's a tremendous opportunity for us to look at that seriously and figure out what we're going to do about that. You know, there's also been some research about the retention issues and why people don't stay in these careers.
Right.
And we need to grapple with that. And that goes to the expectations of the people who are hiring us. you know, boards and CEOs and executive directors, you know, what they expect of fundraisers and the role that they think that we play, or they want us to play. And how that is somewhat in conflict, perhaps, with the work that we really need to be doing, and the expectations that that should be more realistic in the work that we do than perhaps they have. I came out, the last 25 years of my career was spent raising money in an organization that was focused on workforce and economic development issues. And so I was deeply embedded in these concepts around workforce development, skill development, talent development, pipeline issues, primarily working in the realm of business and industry. And what I can tell you from that experience is that the nonprofit industry is no different than the manufacturing industry, for instance, or the healthcare industry. They look at these issues from a supply and demand perspective, as they should in terms of their workforce. Mm-hmm. They're looking at skills and competencies. They're looking at gaps in competencies, and then they're intervening with their employees to skill them up. So training and professional development opportunities that take a person where they are, address the gaps in their skills and competencies, and grow them up to the next level of expertise, and a continual investment in that worker to keep moving them up the chain to managerial and supervisory responsibilities and perhaps leadership responsibilities. In the world of business, that's a very intentional pathway. In fact, they call it career pathways. And it starts down in middle school, talking to middle school students and parents and teachers about this career and how you put yourself on a path to that career and what you need to be studying in school that gives you the underlying knowledge base to be successful in that career. We don't think like that in the nonprofit world. People fall into these jobs if they're not actively planning to pursue them. And you pointed it out in your book, you know, if you're social, you can carry on a good conversation, you're friendly, you know, and you can get people and you can be persuasive to get people to do what you ask them to do. They think that makes you a good fundraiser. Right. And clearly those are parts of the skill set,
sure.
But that's not all that it takes. And in the world of business and industry, they differentiate between hard skill and soft skill. Well, our hard skill would be things like being able to sit down and crank out an annual giving letter,
yeah,
or creating a donor recognition program and giving clubs and that sort of thing. Soft skills for us would be emotional intelligence, you know, relationship building, how to communicate effectively, how to be empathetic and listen. You know, those are the soft skill kinds of things. And so looking at our work as part of an industry with a set of hard skills and a set of soft skills and helping people see the career pathway that they could be on if they chose to do so, that leads them into this work, prepared to do it effectively, efficiently, and taking it into new places it's never been before. And so, you know, I think we have an opportunity here because of these demographic issues, because of the pressure on nonprofits to think about this and come up with some ways to address it. But as we noted in the first episode, it's not just us that need to address this. I really view it, and I'm not trying to be overly dramatic here, but I do think that it is somewhat of a national crisis that if we don't think about this in a broad way with all of the players, government, business, and nonprofits, if we don't think about this in a broad-based way, we're going to arrive 10 to 15 years from now not having what we need to really keep nonprofits vital, make communities healthier and safer and more vibrant themselves, and everyone will suffer as a result.
Are we going to be any better, excuse me, are we going to be any better at supervising 10 years down the road than we are today? supervising fundraisers?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure that executives and leaders and managers actually know how to supervise fundraising professionals.
Yeah.
You know, again, in my own professional experience, a lot of what I was talking about, a lot of what I was suggesting at leadership team meetings and putting on the table, people looked at me with crossed eyes. You know, they were like, what are you talking about?
Right. Well,
why does that matter? Why do you care? Why do we care? You know? And I think a lot of that falls to the people that employ us. You know, they don't fully understand our role, don't understand what we do and how we do it, therefore don't know how to supervise us, certainly do not know how to necessarily give us direction and lead us. And I think that that is probably contributing to some of this turnover, is that you arrive at an organization where those around you do not understand philanthropy in the broad context. They don't understand fundraising as a career choice and as a line of work with a body of knowledge and a set of skills and competencies. And they don't understand how that relates to the work that they do and how it all works together toward moving the organization forward. So, I'm not saying that by pointing a finger of blame at them. I think the responsibility on that has really falls on us. How we have talked about our work, how we positioned ourselves as professionals, how we think about our own work in relation to those, to that of others with whom we work. You know, and this is one of the things that I have instituted in my own consulting practice is understanding the impact that fundraising has on other parts of the organization and how reliant we are on the other parts of an organization participating in our fundraising agenda. And if they don't, then we're working at cross purposes and are struggling to be successful, which could be leading to these retention issues. You've got people who are kind of beating their heads against the wall and fighting against internal forces of an organization because there's this lack of understanding about who they are, what they do, and how it relates to what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, I'm sort of forecasting, trying to be a little prophetic here. You and I can do this together. I'm just picturing this more intentional, because I say this all the time to my guest. Oftentimes I've got a younger, what I call a very enthusiastic, fundraising positive, very intentional fundraiser on the podcast here. And I'm saying young mm-hmm. people, and I teach at the local college here, and I teach nonprofit management courses. And so I'm thinking, okay, we've got this younger, more deliberate career path that's being walked, but if we don't, and then we've got this large generation of millennials coming into the workplace with these, you know, very intentional sort of credentials and a degree of readiness that maybe some of us that are 20 years in, 20, 30 years in didn't necessarily have. But then what that's going to do is it's also going to shine a very big spotlight on this crisis of not knowing how to employ these people appropriately. It'll just sort of become like a phase two of the crisis that you're describing. It won't necessarily be a problem of pipeline per se. It'll be that we can't keep people, you know, there'll be plenty of people coming through the pipeline. We will be credentialing these people, licensing these people, whatever we happen to do in whatever cultural context, but we won't know how to, you know, keep them around.
Well, exactly. You know, and understanding things like organizational culture, you know, the working conditions, you know, development officers work a tremendous amount of overtime for which they don't get paid, as an example. And Penelope Burke found that in her research, is that there's a lot of people working overtime hours as part of their development role for which they're not being paid. And we do it because we think it's part of the job and it comes with it. And we just, it is what it is, right? But that very thing can contribute to burnout, or feeling undercompensated or undervalued or underappreciated. And so we've got to address those workplace conditions and the environment and the culture in which we do our work. The other thing is that if we do not provide the undergirding infrastructure and support and systems in an organization to help a fundraiser succeed, then we've set them up for failure from the day they walk through the door. And that can be very discouraging, and people can really work very, very hard and may have some incremental success. But they're not working on a platform that is set up to make them successful. And then going back to the supervision thing, how does a supervisor or an ED or CEO then assess that person's success? When they were set up from the beginning with less than what was optimal to ensure their success. And so they usually go straight to fundraising results, right? They look at the numbers, right, they look right. at dollars.
Right.
They go straight to the bottom line. And if it's not a bigger number than was last year, they assume the fundraiser was the problem. When in fact, it might have been a host of other things surrounding that fundraiser. Not that they're unaccountable and can blame others, but there's a infrastructure and a set of systems and processes that we all understand undergird the work of a fundraising professional. And if those are not in place or they're not functioning, you referred to it as dysfunctional, right?
Yeah.
It's this dysfunctional environment. And you're putting a fundraising professional in there and expecting them to be successful. It's unrealistic and it's unfair. And so grappling with those realities and figuring out how we address it, both as the professional involved in that environment, working in that environment, what's our responsibility as professionals in that environment, and then the people who are creating are responsible for those environments. What role do they play in this? And getting everyone to that table to have that discussion openly and honestly, I think is one of the big opportunities for us.
Before I let you go, Tim, there has to be who is here. Let me just give you sort of an anecdotal sort of scenario. So somebody recently asked me a question about sort of what are the expectations that we should be, what are the ideal characteristics that we want in a very talented fundraiser? And I said discernment and audacity. Would you put any other characteristics on these? Because, and the reason I answered that question that way is because I was saying that, in today's sort of highly technology driven sort of environment, it's never been easy to secure that initial gift, and yet it's going to be more and more complicated to secure that subsequent gift. Is there any other characteristic you would be looking for other than audacity and discernment?
Well, optimism.
Okay.
I think, again, going back to fundraisers and the people who employ them understanding philanthropy itself and what causes people to want to help by giving and the role that we play in helping people find that opportunity. That's what fundraisers do. We help people find the opportunity to make a difference, to make an impact, and to satisfy their need to make a difference. And that is always going to be the case. That's never going to change. What is changing are the environment and the mechanics around how we have been doing that. That part is changing. But the underlying role that philanthropy plays and how people engage in that is never going to change. And so a fundraiser always needs to be optimistic, because philanthropy is always going to happen. The question is, how do we get it to happen for us in our organizations? And not view that as a problem, but view that as an opportunity to grow, to learn, to figure out new methods for interaction and communication and relationship building as new generations of philanthropists come into the world. And so I think it has to be an optimistic viewpoint. If you approach fundraising as a negative and you're there to solve a problem,
yeah,
I think that could contribute to also not viewing the work as something that you want to do long term. But if you view it from an optimistic perspective, knowing that philanthropy is always going to exist and you have the exciting opportunity to help make that happen for your organization, and see it as a challenge to you professionally to grow and learn how to do that effectively, I think that's the reward for those of us who've been in this work for a long time.
Tim, it has been a pleasure. We're going to lose our listeners if we keep talking too much longer. If somebody's listening and they're like, I want to reach out to that guy, Tim, I want to talk to him, what's your suggestion on how they do that?
Well, I'm happy to talk to anybody. I can give you an email address, tim@birchamsolutionsgroup.com, or they can go to my website for Bircham Solutions online and find me there and use my contact form.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. Very insightful conversation. I look forward to listening to this and processing it myself. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.